The 33 sermons on Nibbana were delivered by the Venerable Bhikkhu Katukurunde Nyanananda in Sinhala at Mitrigala Nisaranavanaya Forest Hermitage. They were translated into English by the same Venerable Monk, presently residing at Potkulkala Forest Hermitage in Kandagedra Devalagam.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Etaṃ santaṃ etaṃ paṇītaṃ yadidaṃ sabba saṅkhāra samatho sabbopadhi patinissaggo tannakkhayo virāgo nirodho nibbāṇa. This is peaceful, this is excellent, namely the stilling of all preparations, the relinquishment of all assets, the destruction of craving, detachment, cessation, extinction. With the permission of the most venerable great preceptor and the assembly of the venerable meditative monks, towards the end of the last sermon, we were trying to explain how the process of samsaric journey of beings could be understood even with the couple of terms itta bhava and anyatha bhava, or thisness and otherwiseness. On an earlier occasion, we happened to quote the following verse in the Sutta Nipata. Tanha dutiyo puriso digha madhana sangsaram itta bhavanyatha bhavam sangsaram nati vattati. It means, the man with craving as his second or as his companion, faring on for a long time in sangsara, does not transcend the round which is of the nature of a thisness and an otherwiseness. This is further proof that the two terms imply a circuit. It is a circuit between a here and a there, or a thisness and an otherwiseness. It is a turning round, an alternation, or a circuitous journey. It is like a rotation on the spot with an ambivalence between a here and a there. It is the relationship between this thisness and otherwiseness that we try to illustrate with quotations from the suttas. We mentioned in particular that consciousness, when it leaves this body and gets well established on a preconceived object, which in fact is its name and form object, that name and form attains growth and maturity there itself. Obviously, therefore, name and form is a necessary condition for the sustenance and growth of consciousness in a mother's womb. It should be clearly understood that the passage of consciousness from here to a mother's womb is not a movement from one place to another, as in the case of the body. In reality, it is only a difference of point of view and not a transmigration of a soul. In other words, when consciousness leaves this body and comes to stay in a mother's womb, when it is fully established there, that place becomes a this place. From the point of view of that consciousness, the there becomes a here. Consequently, from the new point of view, what was earlier here becomes a there. What was formerly that place has now become this place, and vice versa. That way, what actually is involved here is a change of point of view. So it does not mean completely leaving one place and going to another, as is usually meant by the journey of an individual. The process then is a sort of going round and round. This is all the more clear by the Buddha's statement that even consciousness is dependently arisen. There are instances in which the view that this self-same consciousness fares on in samsara by itself, tadevidam vijnanam sandhavati samsarati ananyam, is refuted as a wrong view. On the one hand, for the sustenance and growth of name and form in a mother's womb, consciousness is necessary. On the other hand, consciousness necessarily requires an object for its stability. It could be sometimes an intention or else a thought construct. In the least, it needs a trace of latency or anusaya. This fact is clear enough from the sutta quotations we brought up towards the end of the previous sermon. From the Chetana Sutta we happened to quote on an earlier occasion, it is obvious that at least a trace of latency is necessary for the sustenance of consciousness. When consciousness gets established in a mother's womb with this minimum condition in the least, name and form begins to grow. It draws, as it were, with a flush of branches in the form of the six sense bases to produce a fresh tree of suffering. It is this idea that is voiced by the following well-known verse in the Dhammapada. Yathapi mule anupaddave dalhe chinnopi rukho punareva ruhati evampi tanhanusaye anuhate nibbattati dukkhamidam punam punam. Just as a tree, so long as its root is unharmed and firm, though once cut down, would nonetheless grow again. Even so, when craving's latency is not yet rooted out, the suffering gets reborn again and again. It is clear from this verse too that the latency to craving holds a very significant place in the context of the samsaric journey of a being. In the Anguttara Nikaya, one comes across the following statement by the Buddha. Kammang khettang vinyanang bijang tanha sineho. Kamma is the field, consciousness is the seed, craving is the moisture. This in effect means that consciousness grows in the field of kamma with craving as the moisture. It is in accordance with this idea and in the context of this particular simile that we have to interpret the meaning of the reply of Sela Theri to a question raised by Mara. In the Sagathaka Vagga of the Samyutta Nikaya, one comes across the following riddle put by Mara to the Arahant Nan Sela. Kenidam pakatam bimbam, konu bimbasa karako, kwannu bimbam samuppannam, kwannu bimbam nirujjati. By whom was this image wrought? Who is the maker of this image? Where has this image arisen and where does the image cease? The image meant here is one's body or one's outward appearance, which for the conventional world is name and form. Sela Theri gives her answer in three verses. Naidang attakatang bimbang, naidang parakatang aghang, etung paticca sambhutang etubhangha nirujjati. Yatha anyatarang bijang khette buttang viruhati, athavirasangcha agamma sinehancha tadubhayang, evang khandhacha dhatuyo chacha ayatanayimi, etung paticca sambhuta etubhangha nirujjare. Neither self-wrought is this image, nor yet other-wrought is this misery. By reason of a cause, it came to be. By breaking of the cause, it ceases to be. Just as in the case of a certain seed, which when sown on the field would feed on the taste of the earth and moisture, and by these two would grow, even so, all these aggregates, elements and basics, by reason of a cause, have come to be. By breaking of the cause, they cease to be. The first verse negates the idea of creation and expresses the conditionally arisen nature of this body. The simile given in the second verse illustrates this law of dependent arising. It may be pointed out that this simile is not one chosen at random. It recalls the idea behind the Buddha's statement already quoted. Kammang khettang vinyanang bijang tanha sineho. Kamma is the field, consciousness the seed, and craving the moisture. Here the Venerable Theri is replying from the point of view of Dhamma, which takes into account the mental aspect as well. It is not simply the outward visible image as commonly understood by Nama Rupa, but that image which falls on consciousness as its object. The reason for the arising and growth of Nama-rupa is therefore the seed of consciousness. That consciousness seed grows in the field of karma, with craving as the moisture. The outgrowth is in terms of aggregates, elements and bases. The cessation of consciousness is none other than Nibbana. Some seem to think that the cessation of consciousness occurs in an arahant only at the moment of his parinibbana, at the end of his lifespan. But this is not the case. Very often, the deeper meanings of important suttas have been obliterated by the tendency to interpret the references to consciousness in such contexts as the final occurrence of consciousness in an arahant's life, charimukha vijnana. What is called the cessation of consciousness has a deeper sense here. It means the cessation of the specifically prepared consciousness, abhisankhata vijnana. An arahant's experience of the cessation of consciousness is at the same time the experience of the cessation of name and form. Therefore, we can attribute a deeper significance to the above verses. In support of this interpretation, we can quote the following verse in the Muni Sutta of the Sutta Nipata. Sankhaya vatthuni pamaya bijam sineha massa nanu pavicche save muni jati khayanta dasi takkan pahaya na upeti sankham. Having surveyed the field and measured the seed, he waters it not for moisture. That seed, in full view of birth's end, lets go of logic and comes not within reckoning. By virtue of his masterly knowledge of the fields and his estimate of the seed of consciousness, he does not moisten it with craving. Thereby he sees the end of birth and transcends logic and worldly convention. This too shows that the deeper implications of the Mahanidana Sutta concerning the descent of consciousness into the mother's womb have not been sufficiently appreciated so far. Anusaya or latency is a word of special significance. What is responsible for rebirth or punabhava is craving, which very often has the epithet ponobhavika attached to it. The latency to craving is particularly instrumental in giving one yet another birth to fare on in samsara. There is also a tendency to ignorance which forms the basis of the latency to craving. It is the tendency to get attached to worldly concepts without understanding them for what they are. That tendency is a result of ignorance in the worldlings, and it is in itself a latency. In the sutta terminology, the word nissaya is often used to denote it. The cognate word nissita is also used alongside. It means one who associates something, while nissaya means association. As a matter of fact, here it does not have the same sense as the word has in its common usage. It goes deeper to convey the idea of leaning on something. Leaning on is also a form of association. Worldlings have a tendency to tenaciously grasp the concepts in worldly usage, to cling to them dogmatically and lean on them. They believe that the words they use have a reality of their own, that they are categorically true in their own right. Their attitude towards a concept is tinctured by craving, conceit and views. We come across this word nissita in quite a number of important suttas, particularly in the Udana. It almost sounds like a topic of meditation. In the Channavada Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya, there is a cryptic passage which at a glance looks more or less like a riddle. Nissitasya chalitam, anissitasya chalitam natthi. Chalite asati passadhi, passadhiya asati nati nahoti, natiya asati agati gati nahoti, agati gatiya asati chutupapato nahoti, chutupapate asati neva idha na hurang na ubhayamantare ese vanto dukkhasya. To the one attacked, there is wavering. To the unattacked one, there is no wavering. When there is no wavering, there is calm. When there is calm, there is no inclination. When there is no inclination, there is no coming and going. When there is no coming and going, there is no death and birth. When there is no death and birth, there is neither a here nor a there nor a between the two. This itself is the end of suffering. It looks as if the ending of suffering is easy enough. On the face of it, the passage seems to convey this much. To the one who leans on something, there is wavering or movement. He is perturbable. Though the first sentence speaks about the one attached, the rest of the passage is about the unattached one. That is to say, the one released. So here we see the distinction between the two. The one attached is movable, whereas the unattached one is not. When there is no wavering or perturbation, there is calm. When there is calm, there is no inclination. The word nati usually means bending. So when there is calm, there is no bending or inclination. When there is no bending or inclination, there is no coming and going. When there is no coming and going, there is no passing away or reappearing. When there is neither a passing away nor a reappearing, there is neither a here nor a there nor any position in between. This itself is the end of suffering. The sutta passage at a glance appears like a jumble of words. It starts by saying there is something about the one attached, nisita. It is limited to just one sentence. To the one attached, there is wavering. But we can infer that due to his wavering and unsteadiness or restlessness, there is inclination, nati. The key word of the passage is nati. Because of that inclination or bent, there is a coming and going. Given the twin concept of coming and going, there is the dichotomy between passing away and reappearing, chuti uppatti. When these two are there, the two concepts, here and there, also coming. And there is a between the two as well. Wherever there are two ends, there is also a middle. So it seems that in this particular context, the word nati has a special significance. The person who is attached is quite unlike the released person. Because he is not released, he always has a forward bent or inclination. In fact, that is the nature of craving. It bends one forward. In some suttas dealing with the question of rebirth, such as the Kutuhala Sala Sutta, craving itself is sometimes called the grasping, upadana. So it is due to this very inclination or bent that the two concepts of coming and going come in. Then in accordance with them, the two concepts of passing away and reappearing fall into place. The idea of a journey, when viewed in the context of samsara, gives rise to the idea of passing away and reappearing. Going and coming are similar to passing away and reappearing. So then, there is the implication of two places. All this indicates an attachment. There is a certain dichotomy about the terms here and there and passing away and reappearing. Due to that dichotomous nature of the concepts which beings tenaciously hold on to, the journey in samsara takes place in accordance with craving. As we have mentioned above, an alternation or transition occurs. As for the released person about whom the passage is specially concerned, his mind is free from all those conditions. To the unattached, there is no wavering. Since he has no wavering or unsteadiness, he has no inclination. As he has no inclination, there is no coming and going for him. As there is no coming and going, he has no passing away or reappearing. There being no passing away or reappearing, there is neither here nor there nor any in between. That itself is the end of suffering. The Udana version of the above passage has something significant about it. There, the entire sutta consists of these few sentences. But the introductory part of it says that the Buddha was instructing, inciting, and gladdening the monks with a Dhamma talk connected with Nibbana. තේන කෝපන සමයේන භගවා භික්ඛු නිබ්බාන පටිසංයුත්තාය ධම්මියා කථාය සන්දස්සේති සමාදපේති සමුත්තේජේති සම්පහංසි. This is a pointer to the fact that this sermon is on Nibbana. So the implication is that in Nibbana, the Arahant's mind is free from any attachments. There is a discourse in the Nidana section of the Samyutta Nikaya which affords us a deeper insight into the meaning of the word Nissaya. It is the Kacchayana Gotta Sutta which is also significant for its deeper analysis of right view. This is how the Buddha introduces the sermon. Dvayanisito kvayam kacchayana loko yebhuyena athitancheva nathitanche. Loka samudhyam kho kacchayana yathabhutam sammappanyaya pasato yaloke nathita sa nahoti. Loka nirodham kho kacchayana yathabhutam sammappanyaya pasato yaloke athita sa nahoti. This world kacchayana, for the most part, bases its views on two things, on existence and non-existence. Now Kacchayana, to one who with right wisdom sees the arising of the world as it is, the view of non-existence regarding the world does not occur. And to one who with right wisdom sees the cessation of the world as it really is, the view of existence regarding the world does not occur. The Buddha comes out with this discourse in answer to the following question raised by the Brahmin Kacchayana Gutta. Sammadhitti sammadhitti ti bhanti ucchati kittavata anukho bhanti sammadhitti hoti. Lord, right view, they say. But how far, Lord, is there a right view? In his answer, the Buddha first points out that the worldlings mostly base themselves on a duality, the two conflicting views of existence and non-existence, or is and is not. They would either hold on to the dogmatic view of eternalism or would cling to nihilism. Now as to the right view of the noble disciple, it takes into account the process of arising as well as the process of cessation and thereby avoids both extremes. This is the insight that illuminates the middle path. Then the Buddha goes on to give a more detailed explanation of right view. Upayupadana abhinivesa vinibandho khayam kacchayana loko yebhuyena tanche upayupadanam chedaso adhitthanam abhinivesanusayam na upeti na upadiyati na adhitthati attameti dukkhameva uppajyamanam uppajyati dukkham nirujjamanam nirujjati න කංකති න විචිකිච්ඡති අපරප්පච්චා ඥානමේවස්ස එත් හෝති ittavata khokacchana sammadhitti hoti. The world kacchana, for the most part, is given to approaching, grasping, entering into and getting entangled as regards views. Whoever does not approach, grasp and take his stand upon that proclivity towards approaching and grasping, that mental standpoint, namely, the idea, this is my soul. He knows that what arises is just suffering and what ceases is just suffering. Thus, he is not in doubt, is not perplexed, and herein he has the knowledge that is not dependent on another. Thus, Pātacchāna, he has right view. The passage starts with a string of terms which has a deep philosophical significance. Upaya means approaching. Upādāna is grasping. Abhinivesa is entering into, and vinibandha is the consequent entanglement. The implication is that the worldling is prone to dogmatic involvement in concepts through the stages mentioned above in an ascending order. The attitude of the noble disciple is then outlined in contrast to the above dogmatic approach and what follows after it. As for him, he does not approach, grasp, or take up the standpoint of a self. The word anusaya, latency or lying dormant, is also brought in here to show that even the proclivity towards such a dogmatic involvement with a soul or self is not there in the noble disciple. But what then is his point of view? What arises and ceases is nothing but suffering. There is no soul or self to lose. It is only a question of arising and ceasing of suffering. This then is the right view. Thereafter, the Buddha summarizes the discourse and brings it into a climax with an impressive declaration of his Vayamedya, the middle path based on the formula of dependent arising. Sabbang adhiti kho pachana ayang eko anto, sabbang nathiti ayang dutiyo anto, iti ite kachana ubho anti anupagam majjena tathagato dhammang deseti, avijja pachya sankhara, sankhara pachya vinyanam, vinyana pachya namarupam, and so on up to evametasya kevalasya dukkha khandasya nirodho hoti. Everything exists, kachana, is one extreme. Nothing exists is the other extreme. Not approaching either of those extremes, kachana, the Tathagata teaches the Dhamma by the middle way. From ignorance as condition, preparations come to be. From preparations as condition, consciousness comes to be. From consciousness as condition, name and form comes to be, etc. Such is the arising of this entire mass of suffering. From the complete fading away and cessation of that very ignorance, there comes to be the cessation of preparations. From the cessation of preparations, the cessation of consciousness. From the cessation of consciousness, the cessation of name and form, etc. Such is the cessation of this entire mass of suffering. It is clear from this declaration that in this context, the law of dependent arising itself is called the middle path. Some prefer to call this the Buddha's metaphysical middle path, as it avoids both extremes of is and is not. The philosophical implications of the above passage lead to the conclusion that the law of dependent arising enshrines a certain pragmatic principle which resolves the antinomian conflict in the world. It is the insight into this principle that basically distinguishes the noble disciple, who sums it up in the two words samudayo, arising, and nirodho, ceasing. The arising and ceasing of the world is for him a fact of experience, a knowledge. It is in this light that we have to understand the phrase aparapachya jnanamevasya etthavoti. Herein he has a knowledge that is not dependent on another. In other words, he is not believing in it out of faith in someone, but has understood it experientially. The noble disciple sees the arising and the cessation of the world through his own sixth sense basis. In the Samyutta Nikaya, there is a verse which presents this idea in a striking manner. Chasu loko samuppanno chasu kubbati santhavam channameva upadaya chasu loko vihanyati. In the sixth, the world arose. In the sixth, it holds concourse. In the six, themselves depending, in the six, it has its was. Samyutta 1, Loka Sutta. The verse seems to say that the world has arisen in the six, that it has associations in the six, and that depending on those very six, the world comes to grief. Though the commentators advance an interpretation of these six, it does not seem to get the sanction of the Sutta as it is. According to them, the first line speaks of the six internal sense bases, such as the eye, ear, and nose. The world is said to arise in these six internal sense bases. The second line is supposed to refer to the six external sense bases. Again, the third line is interpreted with reference to the six internal sense bases, and the fourth line is said to refer to the six external bases. In other words, the implication is that the world arises in the six internal bases and associates with the six external sense bases, and that it holds on to the six internal sense bases and comes to grief in the six external sense bases. This interpretation seems to miss the point. Even the grammar does not allow it. For if it is a case of associating with the external sense basis, the instrumental case would have been used instead of the locative case, that is, chahi instead of chasu. On the other hand, the locative chasu occurs in all the three lines in question. This makes it implausible that the first two lines are referring to two different groups of sixes. it is more plausible to conclude that the reference is to the six sense bases of contact, Passayatana, which include both the internal and the external. In fact, at least two are necessary for something to be dependently arisen. The world does not arise in the six internal bases in isolation. It is precisely in this fact that the depth of this Dhamma is to be seen.
In the Samudaya Sutta of the Salayatana section in the Samyutta Nikaya, this aspect of dependent arising is clearly brought out. Chakkhuñca paticca rūpeca uppajjati chakkhu viññānam pinnaṁ saṅgati phasso phasa paccaya vedana vedana paccaya tanna tanna paccaya upādānam and so on up to evametasya kevalasa dukkhakhandasa samudayo hoti. Dependent on the eye and forms arises eye consciousness. The coming together of the three is contact. With contact as condition arises feeling, conditioned by feeling, craving, conditioned by craving, grasping, and so on, up to, thus is the arising of this entire mass of suffering. Here the sutta starts with the arising of contact and branches off towards the standard formula of Paticchasamuppada. Eye consciousness arises dependent on paticca, two things, namely eye and forms. And the concurrence of the three is contact. This shows that two are necessary for a thing to be dependently arisen. So in fairness to the sutta version, we have to conclude that the reference in all the four lines is to the basis of contact, comprising both the internal and the external. That is to say, we cannot discriminate between them and assert that the first line refers to one set of six and the second line refers to another. We are forced to such a conclusion in fairness to the sutta. So from this verse also we can see that according to the usage of the noble ones, the world arises in the six sense bases. This fact is quite often expressed by the phrase Aryasavinaya Loko, the world in the noble one's discipline. According to this noble usage, the world is always defined in terms of the six sense bases, as if the world arises because of these six sense bases. This is a very deep idea. All other teachings in this Dhamma will get obscured if one fails to understand this basic fact, namely, how the concept of the world is defined in this mode of noble usage. This noble usage reveals to us the implications of the expression Udayattha Gamini Panya, the wisdom that sees the rise and fall. About the noble disciple, it is said that he is endowed with the noble penetrative wisdom of seeing the rise and fall. Udayattha Gamini Panyaya Samannagato Aryaya Nibbedikaya. The implication is that this noble wisdom has a penetrative quality about it. This penetration is through the rigidly grasped, almost impenetrable encrustation of the two dogmatic views in the world, existence and non-existence. Now, how does that penetration come about? As already stated in the above quoted Kacchana Sutta, when one sees the arising aspect of the world, one finds it impossible to hold the view that nothing exists in the world. His mind does not incline towards a dogmatic involvement with that view. Similarly, when he sees the cessation of the world through his own six sense bases, he sees no possibility to go to the other extreme view in the world. Everything exists. The most basic feature of this principle of dependent arising, with its penetrative quality, is the breaking down of the power of the above concepts. It is the very inability to grasp these views dogmatically that is spoken of as the abandonment of the personality view, sakkāya-ditthi. The ordinary worldling is under the impression that things exist in truth and fact, but the noble disciple, because of his insight into the norm of arising and cessation, understands the arising and ceasing nature of concepts and their essencelessness or insubstantiality.
Another aspect of the same thing, in addition to what has already been said about Nissaya, is the understanding of the relatedness of this to that Idappaccayata, implicit in the law of dependent arising. In fact, we began our discussion by highlighting the significance of the term Idappaccayata. The basic principle involved is itself often called Paticchasamuppada. This being, this comes to be. With the arising of this, this arises. This not being, this does not come to be. With the cessation of this, this ceases. This insight penetrates through those extreme views. It resolves the conflict between them. But how? By removing the very premise on which it rested. And that is that there are two things. The logicians might come out with the law of identity and the like. According to right view, the very bifurcation itself is the outcome of a wrong view. That is to say, this is only a conjoined pair. In other words, it resolves that conflict by accepting the worldly norm. Now this is a point well worth considering. In the case of the 12 links of the formula of dependent arising discovered by the Buddha, there is a relatedness of this to that, Idappaccayata, as for instance, already illustrated above by the two links, birth and decay and death. When birth is there, decay and death come to be. With the arising of birth, decay and death arise, and so on. The fact that this relatedness itself is the eternal law is clearly revealed by the following statement of the Buddha in the Nidana Samyutta of the Samyutta Nikaya. Avijjapachya bhikkave sankhara ya tatra tatata avitatata ananyatata idappaccayata ayam ucchati bhikkave paticchasamuppado. From ignorance as condition, preparations come to be. That suchness therein, the invariability, the not otherwiseness, the relatedness of this to that, this monks is called dependent arising. Here the first two links have been taken up to illustrate the principle governing their direct relation. Now let us examine the meaning of the terms used to express that relation. Tatha means such or thus, and is suggestive of the term yatha bhuta jnana darsana, the knowledge and vision of things as they are. The correlatives yatha and tatha express between them the idea of faithfulness to the nature of the world. So tathata asserts the validity of the law of dependent arising as a norm in accordance with nature. Abhitathata, with its double negative, reaffirms that validity to the degree of invariability. Ananyathata, or not otherwiseness, makes it unchallengeable, as it were. It is a norm beyond contradiction. When a conjoined pair is accepted as such, there is no conflict between the two. But since this idea can well appear as some sort of a puzzle, we shall try to illustrate it with a simile. Suppose two bulls, a black one and a white one, are bound together at the neck and allowed to graze in the field as a pair. This is sometimes done to prevent them from straying far afield. Now out of the pair, if the white bull pulls towards the stream while the black one is pulling towards the field, there is a conflict. The conflict is not due to the bondage, at least not necessarily due to the bondage. It is because the two are pulling in two directions. Supposing the two bulls somehow accept the fact that they are in bondage and behave amicably, then when the white bull pulls towards the stream, the black one keeps him company with equanimity, though he is not in need of a drink. And when the black bull is grazing, the white bull follows him along with equanimity, though he is not inclined to eat. Similarly, in this case too, the conflict is resolved by accepting the pairwise combination as a conjoined pair. That is how the Buddha solved this problem. But still the point of this simile might not be clear enough. So let us come back to the two links, birth and decay and death, which we so often dragged in for purposes of clarification. So long as one does not accept the fact that these two links, birth and decay and death, are conjoined pair, one would see between them a conflict. Why? Because one grasps birth as one end and tries to remove the other end which one does not like, namely decay and death. One is trying to separate birth from decay and death. But this happens to be a conjoined pair. Conditioned by birth, monks, is decay and death. This is the word of the Buddha. Birth and decay and death are related to each other. The word jara or decay on analysis would make this clear. Usually by jara we mean old age. The word has connotations of senility and decrepitude. But the word implies both growth and decay, as it sets in from the moment of one's birth itself. Only there is a possible distinction according to the standpoint taken. This question of a standpoint or point of view is very important at this juncture. This is something one should assimilate with a meditative attention. Let us bring up a simile to make this clear. Now, for instance, there could be a person who makes his living by selling the leaves of a particular kind of tree. Suppose another man sells the flowers of the same tree to make his living, and yet another sells the fruits, while a fourth sells the timber. If we line them up and put to them the question pointing to the tree, is this tree mature enough? We might sometimes get different answers. Why? Each would voice his own commercial point of view regarding the degree of maturity of the tree. For instance, one who sells flowers would say that the tree is too old if the flowering stage of the tree is past. Similarly, the concept of decay or old age can change according to the standpoint taken up. From beginning to end, it is a process of decay. But we create an artificial boundary between youth and old age. This again shows that the two are pair mutually conjoined. Generally, the worldlings are engaged in an attempt to separate the two in this conjoined pair. Before the Buddha came into the scene, all religious teachers were trying to hold on to birth while rejecting decay and death. But it was a vain struggle. It is like the attempt of the miserly millionaire courtier to eat rice cakes alone, to cite another simile. According to that instructive story, the millionaire courtier, an extreme miser, once developed a strong desire to eat rice cakes. As he did not wish to share them with anyone else, he climbed up to the topmost story of his mansion with his wife and got her to cook rice cakes for him. To teach him a lesson, Venerable Mahamoggallana, who excelled in psychic powers, went through the air and appeared at the window as if he is on his arms round. Courtier, wishing to dismiss this intruder with a tiny rice cake, asked his wife to put a little bit of cake dough into the pan. She did so, but it became a big rice cake through the Venerable Thera's psychic power. Further attempts to make tinier rice cakes ended up in producing ever bigger and bigger ones. In the end, Kosya thought of dismissing the monk with just one cake, but to his utter dismay, all the cakes got joined to each other to form a string of cakes. The couple then started pulling this string of cakes in either direction with all their might to separate just one from it, but without success. At last they decided to let go and give up, and offered the entire string of cakes to the Venerable Thera. The Buddha's solution to the above problem is a similar letgoism and giving up. It is a case of giving up all assets, sabbopadhi patinissagga. You can't separate these links from one another. Birth and decay and death are intertwined. This is a conjoined pair. So the solution here is to let go. All those problems are due to taking up a standpoint. Therefore, the kind of view sanctioned in this case is one that leads to a detachment and dispassion, one that goes against the tendency to grasp and hold on. It is by grasping and holding on that one comes into conflict with Mara. Now, going by the story of the millionaire Kosiya, one might think that the Buddha was defeated by Mara. But the truth of the matter is that it is Mara who suffered defeat by this sort of giving up. It is a very subtle point. Mara's forte lies in seizing and grabbing. He is always out to challenge. Sometimes he takes delight in hiding himself to take one by surprise, to drive terror and cause horripilation in him. So when Mara comes round to grab, if we can find some means of foiling his attempt or make it impossible for him to grab, then Mara will have to accept defeat. Now let us examine the Buddha's solution to this question. There are in the world various means of preventing others from grabbing something we possess. We can either hide our property in an accessible place or adopt security measures, or else we can come to terms and sign a treaty with the enemy. But all these measures can sometimes fail. However, there is one unfailing method which in principle is bound to succeed, a method that prevents all possibilities of grabbing, and that is letting go, giving up. When one lets go, there is nothing to grab. In a tug of war, when someone is pulling at one end with all his might, if the other suddenly lets go of his hold, one can well imagine the extent of the former's discomfiture, let alone victory. It was such a discomfiture that fell to Mara's lot when the Buddha applied this extraordinary solution. All this goes to show the importance of such terms as Nissaya and Nidappajjata in understanding this Dhamma. We have already taken up the word Nissaya for comment. Another aspect of its significance is revealed by the Satipatthana Sutta. Some parts of this Sutta, though well known, are wonderfully deep. There is a certain thematic paragraph which occurs at the end of each subsection in the Satipatthana Sutta. For instance, in the section on the contemplation relating to body, Kaya Anupassana, we find the following paragraph. Iti ajhattam va kaye kaya anupassi viharati, bahiddha va kaye kaya anupassi viharati, ajhatta bahiddha va kaye kaya anupassi viharati, samude dhamma anupassi va kayasming viharati, vaidhamma anupassi va kayasming viharati, samudevaya dhamma anupassi va kayasming viharati, athikayoti va panasya sati pachupaddhita hoti, yavadeva jnanamattaya pati sati mattaya, anisitocha viharati nachakinchi loke upadhyati. In this way, he abides contemplating the body as a body internally, or he abides contemplating the body as a body externally, or he abides contemplating the body as a body internally and externally, or else he abides contemplating the arising nature in the body, or he abides contemplating the dissolving nature in the body, or he abides contemplating the arising and dissolving nature in the body, or else the mindfulness that there is a body is established in him only to the extent necessary for just knowledge and further mindfulness, and he abides independent and does not cling to anything in the world. A similar paragraph occurs throughout the sutta under all the four contemplations, body, feeling, mind and mind objects. As a matter of fact, it is this paragraph that is called Satipatthana Bhavana, or meditation on the foundation of mindfulness. The preamble to this paragraph introduces the foundation itself, or the setting up of mindfulness as such. The above paragraph, on the other hand, deals with what pertains to insight. It is the field of insight proper. If we examine this paragraph, here too we will find a set of conjoined or twin terms. In this way he abides contemplating the body as a body internally, or he abides contemplating the body externally, and then he abides contemplating the body both internally and externally. Similarly, he abides contemplating the arising nature in the body, or he abides contemplating the dissolving nature in the body, and then he abides contemplating both the arising and dissolving nature in the body. Or else the mindfulness that there is a body is established in him only to the extent necessary for knowledge and remembrance. This means that for the meditator, even the idea there is a body, that remembrance,
is there just for the purpose of further development of knowledge and mindfulness. And he abides independent and does not cling to anything in the world. Here too, the word used is anicitta, independent or not leaning towards anything. He does not cling to anything in the world. The word nissaya says something more than grasping. It means leaning on or associating. This particular thematic paragraph in the Satipatthana Sutta is of paramount importance for insight meditation. Here too, there is the mention of internal ajjhata and external bahiddha. When one directs one's attention to one's own body and another's body separately, one might sometimes take these two concepts, internal and external, too seriously with a dogmatic attitude. One might think that there is actually something that could be called one's own or another's. But then the mode of attention next mentioned unifies the two as internal-external, ajjhata-bahiddha, and presents them like the conjoined pair of bulls. And what does it signify? These two are not to be viewed as two extremes. They are related to each other. Now let us go a little deeper into this interrelation. The farthest limit of the internal is the nearest limit of the external. The farthest limit of the external is the nearest limit of the internal. More strictly rendered, ajjhatam means inward and bahiddha means outward. So here we have the duality of an inside and an outside. One might think that the word ajjhatika refers to whatever is organic. Nowadays, many people take in artificial parts into their bodies. But once acquired, they too become internal. That is why in this context, ajjhatika has a deeper significance than its usual rendering as one's own. Whatever it may be, the farthest limit of the ajjhata remains the nearest limit of the bahiddha. Whatever portion one demarcates as one's own, just adjoining it and at its very gate is bahiddha. And from the point of view of bahiddha, its farthest limit and at its periphery is ajjhata. This is a conjoined pair. These two are interrelated. So the implication is that these two are not opposed to each other. That is why by attending to them both together as ajjhata bahiddha, that dogmatic involvement with a view is abandoned. Here we have an element of reconciliation which prevents adherence to a view. This is what fosters the attitude of anisit, unattached. So the two ajjhatam and bahiddha are neighbors. Inside and outside as concepts are neighbors to each other. It is the same as in the case of arising and ceasing mentioned above. This fact has already been revealed to some extent by the Kacchanagotta Sutta. Now if we go for an illustration, we have the word Udaya at hand in Samudaya. Quite often this word is contrasted with Atthagama, going down. In the expression Udayatthagamini Panya, the wisdom that sees the rise and fall. We can regard these two as words borrowed from everyday life. Udaya means sunrise and Atthagama is sunset. If we take this itself as an illustration, the farthest limit of the forenoon is the nearest limit of the afternoon. The farthest limit of the afternoon is the nearest limit of the forenoon. And here again we see a case of neighborhood. When one understands the neighborly nature of the terms Udaya and Atthagama, or Samudaya and Vaya, and regards them as interrelated by the principle of Vidapachyata, one penetrates them both by that mode of contemplating the rise and fall of the body together. Samudaya Vaya Dhamma Anupassiva Kayasming Viharati, and develops a penetrative insight. What comes next in the Satipatthana passage is the outcome or net result of that insight. The mindfulness that there is a body is established in him only to the extent necessary for pure knowledge and further mindfulness. Atthikāyo tivā panasya sati pachupatthitā hoti yāvadeva jñānamattāya patisati mattāya. At that moment, one does not take
even the concept of body seriously. Even the mindfulness that there is a body is established in that meditator only for the sake of Yavadeva, clarity of knowledge and accomplishment of mindfulness. The last sentence brings out the net result of that way of developing insight. He abides independent and does not cling to anything in the world. Not only in the section on the contemplation of the body, but also in the sections on feelings, mind and mind objects in the Satipatthana Sutta, we find this mode of insight development. None of the objects taken up for the foundation of mindfulness is to be grasped tenaciously. Only their rise and fall is discerned. So it seems that what is found in the Satipatthana Sutta is a group of concepts. These concepts serve only as a scaffolding for the systematic development of mindfulness and knowledge. The Buddha often compared his Dhamma to a raft. Mitharanathaya no ghanathaya, for crossing over and not for holding on to. Accordingly, what we have here is so many scaffoldings for the upbuilding of mindfulness and knowledge. Probably due to the lack of understanding of this deep philosophy enshrined in the Satipatthana Sutta, many sects of Buddhism took up these concepts in a spirit of dogmatic adherence. That dogmatic attitude of clinging on is like the attempt to cling on to the scaffoldings and to live on in them. So with reference to this Satipatthana Sutta also, we can understand the importance of the term Nissaya.
Dear listeners, it is our sincere wish to make these sermons accessible, free of charge, to all who like to listen to them, because the gift of the Dhamma excels all other gifts. We therefore encourage you to copy these sermons and share them with others, but kindly note that they should not be reproduced for sale. May the blessings of the Triple Gem be with you.